let's get to the gut level of shame and why shame, what is shame? Shame makes you feel like you have to be right. Bingo.
Well, I mean, that's like, I was thinking about that, I don't know, either today or yesterday, about how, you know, the need to be right, the obsession, you know, to be right.
But we've seen it in here 1,000 times. It doesn't make any difference.
No.
Nobody gives a damn. I mean, time is going to correct whatever is the problems anyway. But shame causes us to be so wounded that we believe that to be right is the only balm of Gilead that we can put on so that we can have a reason for existence. And it's really... It's the tempered mortar. You remember we've talked about
the hole
in the wall in Ezekiel? And God says, you see the hole? Now you mother, start digging. Make the hole bigger. And you say, no, I don't want to dig. I got to be right. I got to put untempered mortar on that wall to make sure that I've got a real secure wall here that nobody can see my shame. I know a little bit about shame. Shame's like a biggie. But again, shame is you know, I'm sure it's because we're talking about it, but all of us and studying it. But all of a sudden, I mean, every place I look in the scriptures, that's all I see is shame. And the fruit of shame and the net effect of shame and everything I saw in all of these little dealy-woppies that we did up there. Shame is death. It's as a hunk of protoplasm, as an organism, as a living organism. Shame is the perception of death with no mourning. Because there's no mourning, it's never dealt with. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger the older you get. So it seems to me that we got to do a little mourning here. We got to understand the legal reasons in ancient Israel why mourning was required. It's perceived separation, and that perceived separation to that small child is death. And it's not mourned for. And so it just keeps adding and adding and adding and adding and adding. We've talked about all of the ways in which we get out of shame here. One is by humor, the ability to laugh at it. The other is the idea that we'd have an environment of unfeigned love where you would trust. But I think the real biggest way to get out of shame is the process or the act of mourning. Now, there was a time when under the law in ancient Israel and under the Talmud, when there was a death, an immediate death of someone that was extremely important to you, what you had to do was you had to mourn for a defined period of time, and we'll get into those specifics later, but fundamentally what you had to do is you had to turn all of your furniture upside down in your house. You had to sleep on the floor. You had to sit on the floor.
You had to wear black.
But there had to be a transaction internally so that the mourning was dealt with. That's why, again, I think what we're going to see as we study this next few weeks is the relationship of shame to the fact that there was no mourning. You didn't mourn for the death, the perceived death. Remember, that's what the transaction occurred from. And you made an offering, and there was a total not acceptance of that offering. And because the offering wasn't accepted, you as that small child perceived it as death. And then all hell broke loose from there. Now, did all of you bring something to write on tonight? No. What I want to try to do on this series of experiments, preparations for Passover, is not to go through some psychobabble of dredging up childhood bullshit, but to find the key two or three points in your memory where you felt abandoned, where you knew that from your standpoint, from your perception of your worth as a person, that you were left to your own devices, you were abandoned. Now, the problem here, let me tell you the problem. My earliest memories they're really sick, because my memories are not me being abandoned. My memories are me running away. And so, but I know myself well enough not to trust that. What that is that's just this template that I've remembered everything through. There's things back here that I have not permitted times we've been through things like this, that I've never permitted myself to hear, to see, that where I know that I felt like the worst person in the universe because something I did wasn't accepted and I was abandoned by the person that I loved the most. Now, I'm going to go through a bunch of stuff that will hopefully jog your memory. But please, let your own sense of self be your guide. I mean, some of you, Harry's going to probably have to write 33 experiences, and we're going to have to sit there and listen to all his little psychobabble.
Maybe he should do a collage or something. That's a great idea.
How did you come up with the concept?
Sure, I don't remember being easy.
Zephaniah, it says to experience the judgment seat of God before it happens. And then that combined with Revelation of the seven mountains on which the whore is sitting, that's seven specific activities of the subconscious that are enemies of faith. Now, I want you to go back now. Go back in time to yesteryear. And normally what happens is the later memories become tells for something earlier. So the thing that triggers it in one of our illustrious elders around here is there are two things that if I do, he goes into orbit and every rational thought leaves him and all of the fears of a thousand experiences of feeling abandoned come upon him and he becomes a raging idiot. And one of them is if I am looking at him and I, just dismiss him with a shake of the head, he just goes into orbit. But the worst one is if I close a book in front of him. If I'm reading he's starting to talk, and I go, and every time he sees that action of the movement of the head, it's a movement or an act of perceived frustration with him as the object or the subject. And the closing of the book is the idea of dismissal. He goes into orbit. And it brings back all of the experiences that he had that are so, so horrible.
Yeah. But different people react differently. I mean, someone else may...
Someone else may just go disappear and sink into the woodwork. Well, that's the kind of thing. And again, the only way that these are worked out in time is to see that you're still accepted in spite of them. Now, but the thing, and again, what we're going to try to do here is to try to maybe even re-experience that feeling of separation and then mourn for it and get it over with. Turn some furniture upside down. Do the legal act of mourning. And that's the component that's missing. The first, I mean, the obvious things that you are trigger mechanisms, other, I mean, the remembering of the first thing, the first, normally you remember a party or some event. And once you can get back to that event, then trigger mechanisms come into being, and you can then associate it fairly quickly with a moment of shame or a moment of feeling of abandonment. You know, what kind of vacations did you have when you were? Did your family go on vacations? Can you recall any of your earlier teachers, the earliest teachers? Just things that come to your mind. Don't worry about trying to figure them out right now. Did you get along with your teachers? What kind of did your family take vacations? We literally left my sister in a restaurant when she was a kid.
Ooh, restaurant alone.
What?
Restaurant alone.
Oh.
The sequel. It's a good thing you didn't leash her to the back of the car.
Yeah.
For some reason, I can remember the specific day I learned to tie my shoes. I remember where I was. I remember the incredible feeling of accomplishment of the idea of tying my shoes. And then I remember how my cousin trivialized it. Everybody tied their shoes. You know, just like, so then I learned to make these dollar bill things, where the, what you call them? Origami. My uncle taught me to do the origami where I could make a bird and nobody else could do that. So then I was, that was my way to combat shame as a child. You remember the day you learned to ride a bike?
What did you say right after party or event?
Teachers. Earliest teachers. You know, what did your family do for fun? What did the people around you do for fun when you were a small child?
And what fun and vacations?
Well,
now, I mean,
the idea then, the only reason I'm saying it is to remind you of those are normally strong experiences that can make you remember something that would happen.
Now, does somebody have to get angry with you to feel shame?
No. No, it's something that happens that causes you to question your work. And it, sometimes it gets to be, you know, everybody has some. There's psychologists say that the sense of shame is what defines, everybody has shame. I mean, it says, the scriptures say, if you cannot blush, if you're without shame, you're incapable of repentance. And that's, sometimes I think that's where I am. I mean, I really get concerned with myself. And I think alone I would be. Alone I would. Without you, I would be without shame. And that would, for some reason, it just frightened me to death. To not, because there wouldn't be any limit to me. I mean, there wouldn't be any. Anyway. But I know myself well enough to know that whatever it is that I've done, I've covered. I could be easily a psychopath, sociopath at least. Anyway, how did you handle bedtime when you were little, the earliest? I mean, were you afraid of the dark? See, a lot of times going to bed became an act of feeling of abandonment, and so it became, you'd do something to try not to go to bed, and they would reject you for it, and it would, you know, these are all. Bedwetting is another. That's a huge act of shame. Once you've allegedly been toilet trained. Again, a few guidelines. The earlier the memory, the better.
I have a question. What is autism?
Autism?
Yeah.
Well,
a lot of theories about learning, isn't it?
nobody really knows what it is.
Nobody really knows yet. Supposedly an inability to communicate.
Yeah.
It's
deep withdrawal.
It's probably, I mean, you know, just off the top of my head, it may very well be related to something, because I know I have some friends that have an autistic child, that he became autistic. I mean, he was normal and then he became autistic. I mean, it was like he went into some deep escape place.
Isn't that what usually?
Huh?
Isn't that what usually happens?
I don't know. I don't know enough about it to.
My nephew has one, 26 years old in Hollywood. They discovers his autism at 18 months. And he has incredible abilities, not like Rain Man, but the kid can, you can give him any word in the world and he can spell it for you. And then you ask him to do it backwards and he can do that. I mean, it's just incredible mental agility in a lot of areas. He can hold a job, simplistic, you know, like he works at a health club counting towels and giving out stuff and like that. But he cannot talk. He cannot communicate at all.
How old
he
is
grunts.
He?
He's 26 now.
Oh, I thought you said he was 6, and I was like, he's holding a child.
I just brought up the point because, as opposed to your friend saying that they discovered his autism at 18 months. And they've been working with him.
Well, interestingly enough, the 18 months is when they say that you first develop capacity for shame.
Yeah, that they began at that point began to notice abnormalities, I guess. He was diagnosed at that.
It is interesting, though, the inability to speak is one of the effects of shame.
Anyway, the earlier the memory, the better. The more early memories that you have, the better. This is the one that gets you, is that the memories must be yours alone instead of this, you know, where somebody has told you about
family
stories or.
About photographs that trigger memories.
That could be, as long as it's a memory. And the memory must involve specific events in order for it to begin to be crystalline. And in other words, I can remember real early, supposedly, I mean, just images, but they're not specific related. I mean, I couldn't assign anything to them. So, anyway, let's go back. Let's go on. The biggest thing that you should look for is something in which you were trying to please, or maybe just your presence, and then, but whatever it was, you perceived that you were that it wasn't just an act of being rejected, like being corrected. It was that your very being was being rejected, and that's as a child, as that entity, you perceive that as death. And normally, it's the first or the earliest memories are always related to the one that's normally your mother, but it's whoever is the primary caregiver, but it normally is your mother. Another aspect of shame is that it's the earliest memories of siblings or peers that teased you constantly. They picked on you, they nagged and harassed under the guise of humor. And all of the relationship, the things that are related to toilet training and accidents, and then their associated put-downs by parents or peers or siblings.
What if it was so constant that no one thing stands out?
Well, then there's probably an event that triggers it. So if something appears to be constant, I would go deeper. So try to go around it some way. This one is especially true for a couple people here, but inferior feelings because your face or body didn't meet some standard. Chronic early illness can trigger shame because you're rejected, especially if it was...
Ooh, throwing up.
Yeah, the really...
Excuse me, I remember that one.
No, but the worst, when I was young, there were a lot of illnesses that you could get where the doctors, where you were quarantined. And so the act of being quarantined puts you in a position of a mindset that was just terrible.
And now the thing on your door.
I mean, they didn't, I mean, it's amazing how many different illnesses we were quarantined over. And when that happened, I mean, you're just a little kid, you don't know anything.
You feel bad and you're separate.
And then, and you're prevented from seeing any of your friends or anybody that's, so that's a biggie. For women, the biggest act of shame, and the feeling of shame for most women, comes when their menstrual cycle begins, and we've talked about that before. I just remembered, I'd forgotten this totally. But when I was real little, I had terrible teeth. And I can remember the shame of not smiling and not opening my mouth because of the baby teeth were just, they just were. All of the traditional, I've got a bunch of stuff written here about the traditional things that we've talked about before, about, you know, for females, there are no breasts, or early or late development, or for the male, the size of the penis, but I think you need to go back before, I mean, we need to go back to the points of rejection, where your person was rejected, when you were as the earliest possible age. If we get into this other stuff, it's just going to turn into psychobabble. Okay. The little things can cause. I remember when a pet got run over. I was mortified. I remember thinking that I was, the reason I was mortified wasn't because the pet got run over. I was mortified because I thought it was my fault that it got run over. One of the things that all of us experience shame from at one point or another was the shame from parents over early sexual experimentation. Don't touch yourself. It was tantamount to pure evil. And relating sexuality to body elimination. All kids played with their, it's just, now it seems unbelievable, but when you are shamed over that, it can feel like your whole being is rejected. There's a whole arena that's really hard to put on paper, to put it, because your mind plays tricks with it, and that's the either physical or sexual or verbal abuse that from parents or peer group or other adults. I know we've had this talk before, so it's nothing new, but if you are afraid that you are going to abuse a child, more than likely you were abused as a child, even though you don't remember it. That's a tell. If you're afraid that you're, if you're on the list for kid watching, and you start feeling this overwhelming, want to just smack them upside the head kind of thing, it's more than likely that you were abused as a child. Anyway, so it's verbal, sexual, or physical abuse. And then there's this, there's a whole category of general shame that it's the shame of getting enjoyment out of something that society or everybody around you expects to be repulsed by. And I don't know how to communicate that very well. Well, I mean, Jeffrey Dahmer is obvious, but every one of you are in, have a deal. Whether it doesn't matter whether you're male or female, but it's perceived cowardice. Letting a friend down. My next one would be a, some form of early homosexual experimentation. If you're a girl, being called a tomboy. If you're a boy, being called a sissy. But that should, I mean, there's a million things that we could add to the list, but I just want those to be something that triggers. Go try to take it to the core. I mean, this is, try to get to a point where you can re-experience that feeling of abandonment, the shame associated with it. Now, it's interesting that in a, in several of the cases during first fruit offerings that occurred. So it's like, it's yeah, I can tell as a body, it's right near the surface. And we need to be free from it. We need to be free from shame so that it doesn't control us any longer as a people. And we really need to be free so that we can learn. You can't, you cannot be in a state of worship, true worship of God with shame as your definition of self. Because it's the worship will always be suspect. It's utilitarian worship, if you can understand what I'm saying. And so we to worship God, to enjoy Him forever, to see for us to enter into this a different state of the spirit that we've been in. It's available. We have to, the shame, the component of shame must be destroyed in us. Anybody have anything that brought up that feel like they need to talk about?
Well, the cowardice thing remains for everybody. We've talked about it before, but that one, I can see a lifetime of that, starting very, very early. And relating to you, like I did to my father, and related to Rick and Gary in particular, like I did to my own mother. But I don't think there's anybody here that I relate to like my mother. I don't think I relate to the group. It's like my mother's missing from this equation.
Well, I can remember, you know, a few really traumatic things, but as far as a continuum, you know, like from, I've heard people say they can remember from age one, or even younger. But, really, the first real memory of my life was when my younger brother died, and I didn't realize that until I joined this group. I mean, I've always said I'm the last of 10 kids, which is a blatant lie. I had a younger brother. You know, he died at the age of 8 months, and he died of pneumonia, and he was sickly from birth. You know, and so Mom packed him around all the time. Well, shit, I was delighted when he died. And I felt, of course, the shame of that, and that I was never going to be able to be loved again because I was glad the little beggar was gone. And, which is a normal reaction. He took my place. You know, I mean, I was considerably younger than the next sibling, and so I was mama's baby, you know. Yeah. That, and then I bounced from that to...
How old was...
I was three at the time. And I bounced from that up to about age six or seven when my grandmother died, which was bad news, because I think I saw a motion picture about that once where a kid ran under the house and stayed there forever, because when a grandmother died, a parent made her go, or I think it was a she, made her go in and kiss her goodbye. And that happened to me.
Oh, yeah.
God, I hated that. That was bad news. I was hiding in the, they had pantries back in those days, and I remember that. And my dad found me and forced me to go in there, you know, and kiss grandma goodbye. And I didn't like the old bitch in the first place.
She didn't like her when she was born.
Yeah, anything else. She was really a mean, cantankerous old lady. But then it was really in that, but those two experiences, I promise you, are about really some school memories. But like Rick says, snapshots is a good description, because what the heck? I went to school a few years there. And then all of a sudden we moved down south, you know, and that's about it. Those are about the only two realistic things that I can see Shane in both of them. Of course, particularly the episode with my little brother. But I've already worked that out. I mean, since the last time we, you know, I've mourned for that, and that's all over.
Well, the reason that it's so important to see this, and this is why Israel did this every year before Passover, is so that you're in a position where you can forgive. If you are in a position where you are still experiencing shame over some offering not being accepted or yourself not being accepted, it's axiomatic that you cannot forgive the person that you experience that rejection from. And because we are spiritual beings, it's just as if that were today. I mean, you understand from the line of... And so if there's anyone that you cannot forgive in your entire life, then God can't forgive you. Now, God's not expecting you to go through and you know, do... I mean... It's the things that the Holy Spirit brings to your mind. I mean, and that's why we have all things in common. So that the experiences that are unique to you will help me remember and help me deal with someone that I may not have forgiven. And that's why this is a kind of put in present language, these kinds of experiences become bonding experiences. That are real bonding. I mean that tie you together closer than blood. But it's so vital that you see that the real core thing here of this is your ability to forgive.
I was ashamed. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm so ashamed of our family because of what I perceived to be poverty. I treated them terrible.
Yeah, but can you understand and you're saying that it made you it makes you a hero? That to say that I was ashamed of my parents and so I treated them badly, it doesn't communicate the feeling that took place in you. It was an external. What took place is this transaction that you still do, that it's like you had to do everything to try to make yourself somebody. And so you would try to do a posture, and I mean, I can see you as a small child doing that. It's not that you treated them badly that is the component that will free you. It's seeing your posturing to avoid the shame that will free you.
What I see right now is how much I hate them. And they were doing the best they could, and I hate them.
But it's not that you hated It's that you hate them. You still hate them. And you're still posturing so that you act like you're not part of them. It's like you can be perceived by your peer group as a hero if you say, I treated them badly because I was ashamed of them. It has to go deeper than that for you to be free. And where it has to go is, you have to see that even in that statement, you are posturing to avoid the shame. And that's where I want you, you know, that's what can free you. I'm not trying to bust you. And I know you feel like I am.
No, I feel frustration in that I don't see that. I feel like I should be able to see that or something. I don't see it.
Well, you understand what posturing is. It's the inability ever to be yourself. It's the constant concern that you have to be concerned with your appearance or your actions or your way you look and appear to other people. Well, that defines you. And what it defines you is, and it, you know, it defines you because you're still so totally ashamed of your parents and your brother and everything, that you can't be, you can't not posture here because you're still posturing here. Am I communicating at all, or am I just...
It's there, but I'm going to... There's a point I can't get past. The point I can't get past is, here we go again. You know, this is another embarrassment. This is another, you know...
Yeah, but it's not. It's never accepted as embarrassment by you. You understand that? Now it's accepted as a... What you've done, and I saw it when I first said it, is you've gone on the defensive.
Yeah, it's like I've gotten it wrong again.
So you've gone on the defensive, and now your whole, everything about you is embraced and clothed in shame now.
Yeah, is part of letting go of the shame, being able to feel whatever that original feeling was.
Yeah, you have to feel that abandonment, that
so
thing.
Posturing then would keep you from feeling it.
Posturing prevents you from ever experiencing it, so you can never repent, so you can never... There can never be the mourning for it because you've always elevated yourself above the mourning, or above the experience. You must suspect that.
I'm lost. I'm back yet. I'm experiencing shame. I'm experiencing shame right now.
But you're not, Harry.
What the hell am I experiencing then? I feel like an asshole. I'm embarrassed. What am I experiencing?
You're using every trick known to the human race to rise above it so that you won't have to experience it. You're expending £1 billion of energy running as fast as you can so that you won't have to experience the shame. And therefore, it's always only... Again, I'm not your enemy, and I don't. You've positioned me and postured yourself so that I am your enemy. Can you possibly understand that when you said, "I'm ashamed because how I treated my parents," that wasn't an act of shame. That was an act of posturing. Can you understand? Can you get it that far?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you see that was really a lie?
Yeah.
Okay. And so then all we have to get to is that point right now. And there's nobody here that...
No, I can see that.
Okay, nobody here is jumping on you.
Like, but it was like, you called me in a lie.
Well, you know, I caught, I mean it, yeah. Now, my point to you, what just transpired, your whatever hot seats we do can be that general. Can you, it's so important that...
It's like immediately damage control.
Yeah.
Immediate damage control.
It's so important that you don't... Do you understand what happens? The fruit of shame is that you separate yourself. Mm-hmm. You become alien from yourself.
It all stems from my father, the fact that I was always waiting for my father. My whole life, I waited for my father. And I'm an expert in waiting. Because my father never came home. He's always got something that kept him from coming home. I can remember putting my baseball and my glove and his glove up there next to each other and just waiting, you know, all night. And then, oh, maybe next night. Maybe next night. There's always a promise. He'd never show up.
But you have to stop and you're not seeing the full effect of it. For you, you weren't waiting. You have to experience the total abandonment that you felt. It's not that you're waiting; you felt abandoned. Yeah. And it's not that you're not waiting. You weren't a good waiter. You're still not a good waiter. You are trying to posture yourself to avoid the shame. I mean, this is both of you are perfect examples of what the mind does. When you're real sincere, but the sincerity is always a cover. So, anyway, this is a hint of what is going to transpire from now until Passover.
But why does your mind, why does it do that? I mean, like at a young age, why do you...
Why? The prime directive survives.
No, because once the first act of abandonment or of separation has occurred, then you, by definition, have to prove to yourself and prove to others that you're successful in that isolation. Mm. By treating them badly, even though we're isolated, or by waiting. But you have to prove to yourself that your whole identity depends on being successful by your definitions of success in that isolation.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Even at that young age?
Even at that young age. Again, remember we talked in China that the person is defined as a human being only when they can smile when they're left alone. The age they can smile when they're left alone, that's the age that they become human. Well, really, that's the age that they become the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. Because then they can have success in isolation. And the tricks and the it's already started. Peace. What I want to do is and it will trust that the Spirit of God will move, and that it'll happen so that and again, you write whatever you want, but you'll find that something somebody else says will trigger a memory that you didn't realize you had. That's what will happen, and it'll come as an explosion. Because that's the bonding that has to take place. That's how we're knit together in love by the Holy Spirit through the act. I mean, it's really the weakness that these things represent are that which is going to cause the bind, the knitting together in love. Now, you understand first, all of you have to see that the act, it's how closely tied this is to the act of being able to forgive.
Yeah.
You understand that if there's somebody there that was this significant other that had put you in that abandoned position and you still respond in shame that you haven't forgiven that person. Okay, what we have to do is in your memory take you back and see that Jesus Christ was there. It was God had you wrapped in his arms, and that was it was his, he did it for his purpose. And once you see that, then you're able to forgive without, you know, rationalizing it from a psychological standpoint. But it's like we together we can embrace the shame. We can first embrace it, then we can see that it's all been dealt with in the cross. We can see that without the shame we couldn't have been here. So the shame will be transformed from something evil. Satan meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Meant it. So that's enough for tonight, I think. But be aware of these things. Begin to open your mind to them. Don't dwell on 60 million things on a list. What you do when you, hear me, this is real important. When you remember something like that as a continuum, it's your mind's attempt to trivialize it. So that you don't have to face a particular. And so you trivialize it to make it seem, you sort of dismiss it. Where actually, in truth, it's probably this momentous thing that took place, and it's the child's mind trying to trivialize it.
Yeah, and by saying it was a continuum, it's what I lived in, it's by that definition saying I was successful, because I'm here, I made it through. It was continual.
And okay, well, just we'll see more and more of this as we go on, but
hey,
big guy.